Hi everyone, welcome back, and good to see lots of happy faces here. Today we are going to be moving ahead with our learning about Eliyahu, and in fact we will actually be meeting Eliyahu in this particular chapter once again. But the truth is that Eliyahu comes in halfway through. What we're going to see is that the main character in this chapter is going to be an engagement between Ahav and Izebel. Ahav and Izebel and Navot. This is the famous story of Navot's vineyard, a story of power, corruption. Some years ago, I happened to be visiting Boston. And I have a student of mine who runs a program for Israeli government fellows at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And these are all people who are going to be, they're doing an MBA or they're doing some sort of master's in government. And then they're going to move into sort of relatively senior positions in Israeli government offices, ministries. And this was a student of mine who was running the program. And she said, Rav Alex, you're in Boston, you're in Cambridge, could you come and teach? I thought, what should I teach them? What can I teach from the Tanakh to some people who are going to go into government? And this was the perek that I decided to teach, which is a story about when figures in power become corrupt, take advantage of their position. So that's what we're going to study today. It's going to make for sobering reading. I imagine that most of you know the story. I'm going to share my screen so you can all see. And I hope people have the source sheets. Maxine, have the source sheets been sent out? People received the source sheet? Okay, fantastic. Okay, so people, you should have the source sheets. And we're not going to take any more time of introduction. Let's go straight into the learning. To make sure that everybody knows the story, I'm going to very quickly read through the story. It'll come in the chat in a second if you haven't got the sheet. And I'm going to read through the story just to make sure we're all on the same page. It'll take hopefully three minutes or so. And then we will start beginning an analysis of this story. Here we go. And it came to pass after these things. We're going to talk about what things. Kerem hayala navotel Israeli, ashebi Israel, etzei lechala chav melech Shomron. The Navot Yisraeli had a vineyard which was in Jezreel by the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. And Ahav spoke to Navot, saying, give me your vineyard for a vegetable garden because it's near my house, and I will give you a better vineyard for it. Or, if it seems good to you, I'll give you its value in money. Navot said to Ahav, God forbid that I should give the inheritance of my fathers to you. Ahav came home, sar v'za'if, in a sullen and furious mood because of the Navot, the Yezreelites. Response, for he had said, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers. And he lay down on his bed and turned his face away, and he wouldn't eat. Jezebel, his wife, came to him and said, why are you sullen? Why won't you come down for dinner? Why won't you eat? And he said to her, because I spoke to Navot the Israelite and said to him, give me your vineyard for money, or else if it please you, I'll give another vineyard for it. And he said, I will not give you my vineyard. Jezebel, his wife, said to him, you now govern the kingdom of Israel. Arise and eat, be merry. I will give you the vineyard of Navot Yisraelite. So she wrote letters in Ahav's name and sealed them with seal and sent the letters to the elders and to the nobles that were in the city that dwelt with Navot. And she said, wrote in the letters saying, proclaim a fast and set Navot at the head of the people and set two men, immoral fellows. In the Hebrew it says, B'nei Bli'al, people who don't have a conscience, rough people, before him, and let them bear witness against him, saying, you curse God and the king, or you curse the king by God's name, it's not clear. And then carry him out and stone him and have him die. And the men of the city, the elders and the nobles who dwelt in the city, did as Jezebel sent to them. As was written in the letters which she has sent unto them, they became the fast and set Naboth at the head of the people. And the two men, the immoral fellows, came and sat before him. And the immoral fellows bore witness against him, against Naboth, in the presence of the people, saying, Navot cursed God and the king. Then they carried him out of the city, stoned him, and he died. They sent to Jezebel saying, Naboth has been stoned and is dead. And when Jezebel heard that Naboth was stoned and was dead, Jezebel said to Ahab, arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth Yezreelix, who refused to give you for money, for Naboth is not alive but dead. And when Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, Ahab rose up to go to the vineyard of Naboth Yezreelix to take possession of it. And the word of God came to Eliyahu Hatishbi saying, arise, go down and meet Ahab, king of Israel, who lives in Samaria, behold, he is in the vineyard of Naboth, where he's gone to take possession of it. And speak to him and say, Haratzachta v'gam yarashta, have you killed and also taken possession? Speak to him and say, thus says the Lord, in the place where the dogs licked the blood of Naboth, dogs will lick up your blood, even yours. And Ahab said to Elijah, have you found me, my enemy? And he answered, I have indeed found you, because you have given yourself over to doing evil in the eyes of the Lord. Behold, I'll bring evil upon you, and will utterly sweep you away. I will cut from Ahab every man child, and I will make your house like the house of Yeravam ben Nevat, and like the house of Baasha the son of Achiah, for the fury with which you angered me and caused Israel to sin. And God spoke to Jezebel and said, or about Jezebel, and said, the dogs shall eat Jezebel in the moat of Jezreel. Wow. He of Ahab will die in the city, shall be eaten by the dogs, and he that dies in the field shall be consumed by the birds. But there was none like Ahab, who gave himself over to evil in the sight of the Lord under the incitement of Jezebel, his wife. And he did very abominably, following idols, according to all that the Amorites did, whom the Lord cast out before the children of Israel. When Ahab heard those words, he rent his clothes, put sackcloth upon his flesh, fasted, lay in sackcloth, and walked submissively. And the word of the Lord came to Eliyahu Tishbi, saying, see how Ahab humbles himself before me? Because he humbles himself before me, I will not bring the destruction in his days, but I will, in his son's days, I will bring the destruction upon his house. That's the story. Poor Naboth. I always find it amazing when I drive up to Israel. Israel is at the foot of the Gilboa Mountain. In fact, you can even visit today the archaeological site of where Ahab's palace in Jezreel stands or stood. You can still see the gateway. And it looks over the valley, the Jezreel Valley in the north of Israel. In the center of the Jezreel Valley is the town of Afula, which some of you will know. You might know the song, the Zionist song, Mi Beit Alpha Ad Nahalal, right? All of those kibbutzim in the beautiful Jezreel Valley, from the word Zerah, right? The word Yisrael, from the word Zerah. And when you get to just near the site of the palace in the ancient city of Jezreel, the name of the junction is called Somet Naboth, Naboth Junction. And I always love it that they didn't call it Ahab Junction or Jezebel Junction or I don't know what, that Naboth's name is still there. Thank God Naboth might have been murdered or killed, but his name still stands over the land, over the vineyard with which he owned. So that is the story. And what we're going to do together is to engage in a slightly slower read than I just did now, and try and get into the text of the story and the central ideas of the story, and try and tease out the key themes. So we're going to start from the very beginning. I hear it's a good place to start. So let's go. Okay. Chapter, verse 1. After what things, right? We just saw that Ahab went to war. Do you remember? Ahab went to war and he, in fact, was victorious twice. God was on his side. And God said, I am going to make you victorious. You'll know that I am God. And Ahab decided that instead of killing Ben-Hadad, he would have mercy on Ben-Hadad. We know, said Ben-Hadad and his men, that the Jewish kings are malchei chesedim. They are kind. They are merciful. There's a good chance that he will show you clemency. And indeed, when they come out and they say, Avdecha Ben-Hadad, he says, Achihu, he is my brother. And he spares his life, makes a deal with him, and sent him home. God was very angry about this. And he was so furious that God was angry, he went home, sar v'za'if, in a very, very sullen and furious mood. So there are at least two connections between this story and the previous one. Number one, in both stories, he goes home in a pretty miserable mood. Sar v'za'eif. But I think maybe more important is this idea that Ahav clearly has a very, very merciful side. When he wants to, he knows how to let somebody who is even a sworn enemy, to let him live, to give him an opportunity to have a second chance, to capitalize on the moment. And the compassion which he showed to Ben-Hadad, the sworn enemy of Israel, is in stark difference to, stark contrast to the lack of compassion that he is going to show to Navot in this story. So I think that helps us understand at least the connection of Achar Hadvarim Eila. It is not the passage of time, but it's almost like a connection point. So let's take a look at what we call the exposition, the first verse which gives us the characters. Kerem Hayal and Avot Yisraeli Asher Yisrael Eitzel Heichal Achav Melech Shomron. And I will already say that I read it in sort of lilting sense, because there's almost this sense, Kerem Hayal and Avot, I'll just relate to another chapter in Tanakh, Isaiah chapter 5, which begins in the following way. He says, Ashirana liyedidi shirat dodi lekarmo. I will sing a song for my friend, the song of my friend to his vineyard. And how does it continue? Kerem hayal liyedidi bekerem ben shemen. My keren hayal liyedidi, keren hayal anavot bekerem ben shemen. Right? We all know that wine can bring somebody to song. Right? We know that Shir Hashirim Asher Lishlomo. Right, so much of the Shir Hashirim, the love happens in the vineyard. The vineyard brings us to a state, but greater is your love than wine. And when we hear this, we're expecting good news. Kerem hayal anavot Yisraeli, like kerem hayal edidi, the kerem ben shemen. So it's a very happy thing to have a vineyard. Navot ha-Yisraeli asher b'Yisrael. Navot, the Jezreelites, which was in Jezreel, or in other words, why is it repeating it? Kerem haya le-Navot ha-Yisraeli asher b'Yisrael. What's it telling us about Navot? And if I read to the end of the pasuk, Eitzel heichal achav melech Shomron. So first of all, what are we hearing about Navot? Not only does he have a very happy vineyard, but he is Navot HaYisraeli. He is Navot the Jezreelite, who happens to be in Jezreel as well. In other words, it's not that he happens to be in Jezreel. He's lived here for centuries, his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather. You'll see that the reason why he doesn't give it to the king is because he says, I don't want to give Nachalat Avotai. This is my an ancestral inheritance, the inheritance of my fathers. So Navot is embedded in this soil, right? Like we say in Bnei Akiva, Kapenu Berig Ve'admata, our fingers in the clods of the earth, right? That's who he is. Those are his memories, his childhood memories of walking down the little lane down to the spring in order to draw water. And as a child, he probably played in the same vineyard, helping his father or grandfather to pick the grapes at harvest time. However, his vineyard is Eitzel Hichal Achav Melech Shomron, and this is a very clever technique, because on the one hand, it's telling us that Achav is the Melech Shomron. First of all, he doesn't really belong here. This is his, you know, this is his winter palace. He's got another home. He really belongs in the capital city in Shomron. But the little farm yokel from Navot, Navot Israeli, Asher Israel, who loves his field, who knows the smell of the ground, he's a bit out of his league. He's Eitzel Heichal. He's right next to the palace, the Melech, right? He's playing way below his, way above his weight, as we would say in boxing terms, right? He's out of his league. He's not going to be able to stand up to this Melech, even if he is out of place. So you can see how delicately the opening pasuk manages to tease out so many themes. I love it. And by the way, let me just mention that many of my reflections on this chapter come from a wonderful article on this, a very close reading by Professor Yair Zakovich, who wrote an article. It's actually not in Yair Zakovich's books. It's in another book, a book by Professor Meir Weiss. But whichever way, he has this fabulous read on the chapter, and I've used quite a number of his reflections. So what do we say? Ha'omer davar b'shem omro mevi geula le'olam, right? And where do we learn that from? Since it's topical, we're coming up to Rosh Chodesh Adar, right? That it was said in the name of Mordechai to the king about Bigtan and Teresh. And as a result of that, we know that we got the geula. So this is the time of year where we should mention what our sources are and who has inspired us in our learning. So I will mention Yair Zakovich in this regard. Okay, so beautiful first pasuk. We learned a lot. Okay, we've got the connection to the last chapter by Yacharad Rima'ela, both in terms of Achav's mood and in terms of the contrast between his mercy there and his cruelty here. We've got this notion of Navot HaYisraeli Asher BeYisrael, this man who's totally connected, and this power imbalance between the local man and the king. And now what happens is the following. Give me your field, because I want it for a vegetable garden, right? This is way before Michelle Obama, okay? Planting vegetables at the White House. And because your field is right near my house. Interesting that Achav doesn't talk about my palace. He just says Beiti. I can give you a better vineyard if you like, or I'll pay you full price for the field. Is this a fair deal? I think it is. In fact, Achav is pretty much showing quite a bit of vulnerability here, I would say, the way we talk today. I've sort of developed some green fingers. I'd like to have fresh vegetables. I'd like to have my salat Israeli freshly picked. So maybe we should call it my salat Israeli. Freshly picked, and I want a little vegetable garden. And you know what? I'll give you even a better vineyard if you like, or I'll pay you full price. I don't know whether this is when he says Tanali. Is this an order? Is this an offer you can't refuse, or is it a request? He doesn't say nah. He doesn't say please. He says Tanali. After all, he is the king. But the interesting thing here is, okay, that he's giving him a very nice offer. He explains why he needs it. Achav almost finds a need to justify himself. And the fascinating thing is that Navot says to Achav, "Chalila li me'ashem mititit nachalat avotailach. I can't, God forbid it. I can't give you the inheritance of my fathers." And interestingly enough, Achav goes home sullen and furious, sar b'za'ef, in a rotten mood, ala davar shediber elav navot Israeli, right? And what does he do? He goes to bed, right? Like a impetuous teenager, right? But yishkav al mitato, he's in a pretty bad mood. Won't come down for dinner, right? Yishkav al mitato, he lies on his bed, ve'asev et panav, he faces the wall, v'lo achal lechem, and he wouldn't come down for dinner, right? So lovely the way they describe him. Now, what is it? Now, the interesting thing here is Achav clearly finds himself with his hands tied behind his back. It seems that Achav goes, has a big temper tantrum, and he goes, gets all depressed. It's almost as if, what would you expect him to do? If he was within his rights, he would say, here's a royal writ. I am sequestering this field and you don't have a choice. But it would appear that in fact, Achav doesn't have rights to take this. And I'm going to look down at the bottom of page 2 on our sheet, where I put here some sources, the king versus the people, who has the power. Interestingly enough, this notion of Nachalat Avotai, we all know that the land of Israel is divvied up to the people, to to all of the tribes. And there is a concept of Geula. We all know this from Megillat Rut, I imagine, where in Megillat Rut, even though the family have fallen on hard times and it seems like they have sold their field, there is a responsibility on the family to restore the ancestral lands to the family. And that's exactly what Boaz did with Ploni Almoni. They went to the gate of the town, and the man who is meant to do this is called the Goel, the Redeemer. Where do we get this concept from? It comes from Parshat Bahar, Vayikra Perek Hafhei, which talks about the notion of Shemitah, that the land, on the one hand, isn't really ours, but on the other hand, let's see what it says here. V'ha'aretz lo timacher litzmitut ki li ha'aretz ki gerim v'toshavim atem imadi. The land should not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine, says God, and you are but sojourners and residents with me. The land isn't really owned by you. It's sort of leased by you. Every 50 years, it goes back to its ancestral owner, Yovel. And what does he say? Uvechol eretz achuzatchem geula titanu la'aretz. And through the land of your possession, you shall give redemption to the land. And if you look, I put it in the Hebrew, but not in the English, sorry. Ki amuch achicha, for example, if your brother becomes poor, your relative, or machar me'achuzato, and he sells his estate, uvogalo akarov elav v'ga'al et min karachiv, his relative should come and buy it back. You know, even with the story of Benot Selofchad, we all know the story of the Selofchad's daughters, where Selofchad was a man who had five daughters, and usually land is inherited through the male line, and they said, there is no male line, so we want the land, and they get the rights to the land. Very famous perek. But there's actually an appendix to the story, or a part two, because what happens in part two is that the tribe of Manasseh come along and say, whoa, wait a second. If these girls have inherited land, then what will happen if they marry a man from Reuven or Shimon or Yisachar or Zebulun? Then the land of their children will be a Yisacharite or a Zebulini or a Reuveni, and they'll lose the land. So they make a second law. Women can inherit, but when women inherit, right? Let's take a look. An inheritance shall not be transferred from one tribe to another, for each person of the children of Israel shall cleave to the inheritance of the tribe of their fathers. Here's the phrase, right? They've got to nachalat mate avotav yidbaku. They should stick to it. V'chol bat yoreshet nachalami matot b'nei Israel, lecham mishpachat mate avia tiyeh leisha. And if a woman inherits land, so that the land won't leave her inheritance, what she should do is marry within her tribe. In other words, the Torah takes very seriously this tribal association with land. Every 50 years, the land is, however successful or unsuccessful the farmer has been, the land goes back to the tribe in question. And if a girl inherits land, since inheritance is usually through the male line, she should marry within her tribe, so the Nachalat Avotav doesn't get lost. In fact, when the Rambam rules the question of whether a king can sequester land, let's just take a look. He says the king is allowed to take taxes if he needs them for war, letzorech hamilchamot, and v'lokeach hasadot v'hazitim v'akramim, he can take fields, olive orchards, and vineyards for his subjects when they go to war, only in a war situation, and only if they have nothing to eat. And then he must pay for them. Here, Achav is not at war, and they have what to eat, and therefore, it would seem to be, both according to the Rambam, which of course, Achav wouldn't have known, but the Rambam is reflecting the ancient tradition, and according to the Torah, ancestral inheritance is so serious that even the king's hands are tied behind his back. Now, I want to say something here, a more broad statement. I find this a remarkable thing. You know, when we think about monarchy, we live in democracies, and I imagine that most of us are happy that we do. And we know that we all have rights. And frequently we imagine that when we lived under a monarchy, the king had supreme power, and the king could run roughshod over all sorts of, you know, over the peasantry. As we read, I don't know, I used to learn about this in British history. And the peasantry don't have too, you know, the landowner, you know, you don't have much power against the king. What do we see here? We see that actually in ancient Israel, the common person, the common farmer, has huge power against the king. And I remind you, when the city of Shomron, we learnt this in our first class, that when the city of Shomron was set up, Omri, Ahab's father, bought it from a man called Shemer. And he didn't call it Omron, he called it Shomron, thereby preserving the original ancestral owner. It almost seems like this is a very, very broad ethic, a very broad sensibility in ancient Israel, that the land belongs to the people. And even the king might have a lot of powers, but he doesn't have the power to wrest a vineyard from Naboth. And I think this is very, very clear to Naboth, to Ahav, and that's why he goes to bed in a big bad temper, because he can't do anything about it. Once you utter those words, Nachalat Avotai, the king is not within his legal rights to take this land. And in fact, notice again what Naboth says, Chalila li mehashem. This is not about the king. This is really about an affront to God. Nothing personal to you, Ahav. I respect you. You are my monarch. You are my leader. However, I could never do this because this would be against the laws of Hashem. Sandra, you raised your hand. Yes.
I think it's evident, too, that Naboth's answer to the king was so brief and used the magic words, Nachalat Avotav, and then he closed his case. He didn't blubber, he didn't blather, he didn't expound on it. He used the magic words, which should have stopped Ahav in his tracks. So that I think that Naboth's response to the king supports your whole argument that in the Torah and in that place and in that time, calling on Nachalot Avotai would stop a sovereign from taking your land. Those were the magic words that would have stopped him. And the example is that he doesn't even embellish. All he does is use the magic words, and the king should have gone away, and that would have been the end of it.
So the king actually did go away, but that's Carol wrote in the chat. The thing is, he has a wife who doesn't share these Jewish sensitivities, right? And here, let's take a look what happens very next. By the way, it's not only Nachalat Avotai, correct, but I also want to point out the phrase, Chalila li me'ashem. Okay, so the Lord forbid it to me. Okay, so he goes home, verse 4, and sullen and furious because Naboth the Israelite said, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers. And he goes to bed, turns his face away, and wouldn't eat. Jezebel says to him, why are you in such a bad mood? Why won't you come down for dinner, right? Verse 5. Verse 6, he says, I spoke to Naboth, the Jezreelite, and I said to him, give me your vineyard for money, or else, if it please you, I will give you another vineyard for it. And he answered, I won't give you my vineyard. And here's the critical point. Well, I'll come back to this in a minute. Jezebel, his wife, said unto him, you, now, govern the kingdom of Israel. I'll read it in Hebrew. Ata, you. Ata, with an ayin, right? Now, ta'asem luchal Yisrael. Remember, Jezebel is the daughter of Baal, the king of Sidon. She says, I don't know, why are you being such a pushover, Ahav? I don't know what my father would do. He'd send us some guards, and they would basically, you know, give him an offer he cannot refuse and say, you don't have a choice. That you now to Asem Luchal Israel. In other words, you know, be a king, not even be a man, be a king. It's clear to me that at this point there is a pause in the narrative because Ahav doesn't answer her. He's still in bed facing the wall. And then she works on a second tactic. She says, Kum, get up, and pay attention to this phrase, Kum. We're going to talk about this word. Echol lechem v'yitav libecha, go be happy. Ani etein lecha et kerem Naboth Yisraeli. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth. In other words, if you're not going to do it, I'll do it, right? I even hear a sigh there before she says it. Okay. Now, let me just, if we're already here, let me just say a couple of things. There's some discussion about the way Ahav talks to Jezebel. Zakovich wants to suggest, I put it at the bottom of the, I put it on the sheet, that he talks much harder to Jezebel than he spoke to Naboth. Look what he said to her. He says, I spoke to Naboth the Israelite, And I said to him, give me your vineyard for money, or else if you please you, I'll give you another vineyard for it. What did he really say, right? He said to him, I've got a vegetable garden. He missed that out, right? And he says, I'll give you, he told him, not he'll give him another vineyard, he'll give him a better vineyard, right? A better vineyard, do you remember he said? Or he'll give him money. So he first of all says, doesn't mention the vegetable garden. He also doesn't say that I'll give you a better vineyard, and he mentions the money first. Now, what this shows me is that Ahab is a little intimidated by Jezebel, and he doesn't want to tell her the whole truth. Now, the truth is, it might be, I'm sure, you know, it just might be a husband-wife thing. I have to say, like, I can imagine the scene. Let's say I would go to the garage and the car had broken down or something like that. And I'd call up my wife. I'll say, oh, yeah, he says it's 1,000 shekel to fix the car. And, you know, or I'll come home and I'll say it cost 1,000 shekel. And she'll say to me, did you remember to tell him that 2 months ago you fixed the car and it cost us 1,000 shekel then? And I'm like, maybe I did or maybe I didn't, right? But there are all those moments where, I mean, we're all truthful to our spouses, obviously, but there are moments where we sometimes want to twist and sound that we were a little more tough than we were when we forgot to be tough. So this might not be, you know, this might be in every single marriage, but you definitely gain the sense that Ahab was a bit softer with Navot himself, right? Which with, than he spoke to Jezebel. But I'd like to say something else at this point and really get to the central, I think, point that we want to say about this chapter. She says, right, arise, kum, arise. And actually, she's going to, you know, this whole line, kum echol lechem, ani etenecha karen avot Yisraeli. Now, if we go down, let's look at the next conversation they have. Okay? The next conversation they're going to have is in Pasuk 15. And when Jezebel heard that Navot had been stoned and was dead, Jezebel said to Ahav, arise! Look, the same kum, right? The same verb, right? Kum. By the way, he's been in bed the whole time, it sounds like. Reish et kerem Navot. Pay attention to the word reish as well, right? Which usually means to inherit, right? Inherit in war. Hashem e'en latet lecha b'kesef ki e'en avot chai ki mit. Right? And what does Ahav then do? When Ahav hears this, verse 16, what does he do? Vayakam Ahav lared el kerem Navot Yisraeli l'rishto. In other words, he totally is being, one could say, controlled, manipulated by his wife, right? He rose, right, to take possession. Okay, now, what do I want to point out here, and what's the critical thing? If you look at the sheets on page 3, what you see on the screen right now hopefully should illustrate very nicely the structure of the story. Imagine that we were putting this on stage, right? This would make a great Shakespearean drama. And imagine we were staging this. So we would have 5 scenes. Scene number 1 takes place in the vineyard. Ahav is talking to Nabot. Scene number 2, Ahav and Jezebel at the palace. Scene number 3 happens in the town of Yisrael, in the village. And that's where we have Jezebel, the elders, the witnesses, and Nabot is stoned. Scene 4, back at the palace. Okay? Ahav and Jezebel. And the last scene happens back in the vineyard when Ahav goes out to check out the vineyard and to see what he's going to plant where. And then it's Ahav and Eliyahu. So the first thing I want to notice is that, first of all, you see how symmetrical this is, right? Ahav and Jezebel, Ahav and Jezebel, Ahav and Navot, you know, vineyard, palace, Jezreel, palace, vineyard. Okay? Of course, the lovely thing here is that Navot, who can't speak for himself because he's dead, will have a surrogate. He'll have somebody representing him, and that's Eliyahu. Eliyahu is going to stand in the vineyard representing the spirit of Navot, and saying the things that Navot could never say because Navot has been murdered. But the other wonderful thing here, and this is why I've called this a perfect murder, is of course that, you know, if I'm thinking in sort of like Watergate terms, right, there's no paper trail. Well, we'll see in a minute, there are a little bit. But what I mean is, Ahav is in every single scene, apart from one, the murder scene. Ahav's in scene one, he's in scene two, he's in scene four, he's in scene five, and in scene three, the murder scene, he's nowhere to be found. In fact, he apparently has been in bed the whole time. She said, come and eat, right? I'll give you Navot the Israeli. And the next time she comes back into the bedroom a day later and says, time to get out of bed, Navot is dead. Ahav, of course, doesn't say, that's very strange. He seemed pretty healthy when I saw him yesterday. What happened? Right? Did he have a car accident? Or he doesn't say a word because he knows what his evil has done. However, you can put Ahav on a lie detector test. He will not know any details. He doesn't know what has been written in his name. He doesn't know the plot. He doesn't know who the witnesses are. He knows nothing. All he knows is Ahav is Navot is dead. And here's the critical thing. In the murder scene, Ahav is nowhere to be found. Ahav has no knowledge. And yet, who is pinned with the entire impact of this murder? It is Ahav himself. In other words, I know you don't know, but you know enough. And you know what your wife's up to. And this is happening in your name. And therefore, you bear the moral culpability. And this is quite an amazing statement. And I think it's so beautifully structured, this story, that really Ahav knows nothing. And yet he is fully morally culpable here, even though he hasn't lifted a finger. He has allowed the people around him to engage in the machinations which will bring this man's death about. And it serves him well that he doesn't know. He can get things done by not knowing. I'm not sure where to go at this point, but let's just go to the murder scene and see one thing about the murder scene. Okay, you know, I'll stop the share so we can, because I don't need this. Oh, hold on a second. So let's go back to our text. Oh, I need the text. Silly me. Let's go back. I need the text. Let's go back to the murder scene and let's just take a look at what happens. And I want to show you how ugly it is, the murder scene. First thing I want you to see, verse, let's read it in verse 9. She wrote in the letter saying, proclaim a fast and set Navot at the head of the people. In other words, Navot is to be completely unsuspecting. Usually a fast was in a case where something terrible had happened. There was maybe no rain. And we've seen that rain's a problem. And a Navot's the head of the people. In other words, Navot is the chazan. He's the Rav. He's giving the drasha. Shows that Navot is a very, very respected man in town. And set two men, immoral fellows, before him and let them bear witness against him, saying, you curse God and the king. Now, this is essential, right? This is essential because if he has cursed the king by God's name, he has blasphemed God and he's blasphemed the king. And he's engaged in an act of treason. If he had just committed a crime, then his relatives would inherit his field. But because he's committed a crime against the crown, then the king himself will inherit his field. So it has to be that his vineyard will go to Ahav. It has to be a plot where he has conspired against the king. And then carry him out and stone him and have him die. Now, I'll say a couple of things. Why do I say that this is so cruel? Think about it. She sends this to the elders of the city, right? If you take a look, verse 8, right, what does she say? She wrote in Ahav's name, sealed them with his seal, sent the letters to the elders of the nobles of the city. These are the people who grew up with Navot HaYisraeli. They grew up with him. They've davened in shul with him. They danced at his son's bar mitzvah, right? They all know each other. And clearly, they're so terrified of his evil, they're willing to sell their friend, their community member, to his death, because otherwise there'll be worse things coming. And this is exactly what she does. It's actually very interesting. When she talks about these evil witnesses, she said, that Hoshivu Shnayim Anashim Bnei Belial Negdo, let them face him. When they actually do come and testify, you know what it says? It says, Vayishvu Negdo, they sat opposite him, but when they testify, verse 13, Vayaidu Anshei Belial et Navot Neged Ha'am. When they actually do the testimony, they face the people because they cannot look him in the eyes. These people cannot face Achav. They cannot look him in his eyes because they know they're telling a terrible lie. So this is really quite a gruesome murder. Really, really awful. And I'm sure, especially at this time of year, you're hearing a different story behind all of this. Right? Where else do we have a case where, what does it say here? Maybe if I say it in Hebrew, everybody will hear it very well. Right? V'tichdo sarim b'shem ha-melech, v'tachdom b'tabat ha-melech. Right? Right? You're all thinking about, of course, right? Where? Haman sends the letters on behalf of Ahasuerus to kill the Jews. Just like Isabel is sending letters on the behalf of Achav in order to fabricate some claims about Navot. Right? Now, this is quite amazing because obviously the author of the Megillah is a late book, obviously, and it's using the language of this chapter and the images of this chapter. But do you understand what the implication for the Megillah is? You know, we all remember that scene where Esther points the finger at Haman. But according to this story, what they're actually saying, she should be pointing the finger at Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus, you allowed this to happen. My goodness, right? What's going on there? So this is quite something, right? That Ahasuerus, by actually borrowing this imagery, right? How much we always talk about, we're so happy that Haman's dead, but there seems to be something by using this story, which is actually, you know, everything's masked in the Megillah, but with this little mask, the Megillah's not letting Ahasuerus off the hook and is saying, right, you know, maybe Ahasuerus is going to live to rule another day. And yet at the same time, there's something very, very, he acts all innocent, but he's not as innocent as you think. So, you know, feigning ignorance in this regard. Mihu zeh ve'ezehu, says Ahasuerus. Just a few weeks ago, you were sitting there signing the death writ, and now you're claiming you don't know. You can claim you don't know, but we know. All right, back to our story. So I want to just deal with one last thing, because I see our time is marching on. Then I'll pause if anybody wants to ask a question. I want to just deal with one last point about the notion of the sin here. And this is what I put at the bottom of page 3. Sorry, try again. At the top of page 4, and I've called it the transformation of Navot's refusal. And to my mind, this really goes down to the core. This drills down to the core of this chapter, which I think is really about the temptation of sin, the psychology of denial, and the abuse of government systems, where you can sort of hide behind a bureaucracy and claim you don't know, but still the prophet is going to say that you bear the moral culpability. Take a look at these four versions. The transformation of Navot's refusal. We've studied quite in depth Navot's refusal. Chalila li Hashem mititiet nachalat avotai lach. And we said that what we had here was, God forbid that I should give the inheritance of my fathers to you. Okay? In verse 4, he goes to bed in a temper. And it says, because he said, lo etein lecha nachalat avotai. Now look, you know, even before I do this, I don't know if you ever had this process where, I don't know, this can happen in all sorts of different directions, but maybe somebody got angry with you and you apologized. And then you get home and you say, to apologize. I didn't need to say anything. He was wrong. And then you think about it again and you say, oh my gosh, you know, he was really out of order. And by the time you finish thinking about it, you've totally, you know, when you first spoke to him, you were quite, self-effacing. But when you finish thinking about it, you've totally transformed. Sometimes we play games in our head, right? And the games in our head, a good example is in the book of Shoftim, in the story of Pesal Micha, where Micha's mother loses some money, 1,100 shekels, and she loses the money. She says, you know what? If I ever get the money back, I'm going to donate it to tzedakah. When she eventually donates to tzedakah, she only donates, I think it's 200 shekels to tzedakah. What happened to the other 900 shekel, right? Well, you know what? When she didn't have the money, she said, I'll give it all to tzedakah. When she had the money, she's like, you know what? You know, I spent a lot of money trying to look for it and wasted a lot of time. You know what? Maybe not the whole 1,100. And you know what? I said it, but I was it. And slowly, slowly, by the time she makes the donation, it's suddenly 200 shekel. Our brains play funny games with us. And this, we're going to see Achav's brain messing with him. We know what Navot said. Now, what did Achav hear? He heard, Lo etein lecha nachalat avotai. Right? I won't give you nachalat avotai. First of all, notice that this idea here is there's no chalil ali me'ashem. In fact, if you notice, the word in the Hebrew, in the first pasuk, verse 3, is, woe to God that I should give my inheritance of my fathers to you. But you, the word lach, is at the end of the verse. Here, it's lo etein lecha en nachalat avotai. In other words, before, what he was saying was, this is a religious principle, it's not personal. What's Achav heard when he goes to bed? Lo etein lecha en nachalat avotai. You're not worthy, I would say, of giving my ancestral inheritance. Now, what's Achav thinking? I'm the king. I'm not worthy. Lo etein lecha. Notice, Achav doesn't hear the word God at all here. He doesn't make it a religious principle. Suddenly it's becoming personal. What? He's not going to give a sentimental heirloom for me, but I'm the king. Where's his loyalty? The third time, in verse 6, Jezebel says, what's up? And he says, I gave him a very nice offer. And he said, Lo etein lecha et karmi. I won't give you my vineyard. Whereas here, it's totally me against you. And after all, I'm the king. There's no nachalat avotai. That's suddenly been erased from the narrative. And when Jezebel has actually killed him and she comes back, she says, Navot, Hashem me'ein latet lecha b'kesef. Who refused to give you the vineyard of Navot, the Israeli, for money? Hashem me'ein latet lecha b'kesef. That greedy good for nothing. In other words, from religious principle, it became personal. From personal, it became even more personal, or an act of disrespect. And in Jezebel's version, he refused to give it to you even for money. You were so generous, Achav. And he is such a greedy man. He really deserves to die. This justification, you know, every person is a human being, and we all have to live with ourselves. And therefore, sometimes we engage in this very, very subtle process where our brains play little tricks with us. And this is what, by repeating the verse four times, this is what is happening here. As we see Achav and Izebel justifying this murder, there's no other way to call it, with it. And therefore, Eliyahu is sent, as we said, as the surrogate of Eliyahu to say, Haratzachta v'gam yarashta, what you've killed, and you want to reap the benefits. You want to yarash, you want to go in there as the victorious, usually la reshet t'aretz means to conquer the land. You didn't do a thing. In fact, you just murdered a man. You didn't, achieve this through any licit means. Okay, I don't know if anybody wants to say something. I've still got a couple of things to add. And we haven't really got to the end of the story. But let's, Malka asked, why would Navot's heirs lose the inheritance? Because it's an act of treason, because he has cursed the king, right? Karen asked a question to the story of David and Bathsheba, and it's a really good, we're not going to have time to discuss the connections with that, but it is a very interesting story, interesting question about when kings over abuse their power, but I'm going to have to stay in this story for now. Is there any urgent question for now? Okay, so then I'm going to try and move on because I see I've only got 9 minutes. We've got two topics to deal with. One is the impact of this story, and I want to say a few words about that. And then we'll talk about Achav's tshuva or not. Let's go back to the story. Here we go. Of course, by the way, just like in the last chapter, what we saw with the juridical parable, where the Navi meets him as he's coming back from war and pretended that he was a soldier and sort of caught him in the trap. This is a typical thing Naviim do, catch the king in the trap. And here, of course, the same thing happens. Just like Izebel said to Ahab, arise. So God says to Eliyahu, arise, kum, raid, right? Likrat Ahav, Melech Yisrael Asher B'Shomron, Hinei B'Kerem Navot, Asher Yarad Shtam Nurishton. Notice again, Melech Yisrael Asher B'Shomron, he doesn't even belong in Jezreel. What's he causing trouble there? And he's in Kerem Navot's field, and say to him, Haratzachta V'Gamirashta, and also say to him, where the dogs lapped up the blood of Navot, they will lap up your blood, Ahav. Ahav responds in verse 20, and he says, what's his response? Hamatzatani Oivi, have you found me, my enemy? The first thing Ahav tries to do is turn something which is a matter of religious principle and make it personal. Sound familiar, right? In other words, Eliyahu is coming with all the impact of a divine fiat, a divine judgment. And what does he say? Have you found me, my enemy? In other words, Eliyahu, you've always got it in for me, right? You're always causing trouble. But of course, he says, I found you because you've given yourself over to doing evil in the sight of God. In other words, it's not me. It's B'nei Hashem, right? It's got nothing to do with me. I've got no vested interest here, right? I have found you because you have lihitmaker. In modern Hebrew, lihitmaker is to become addicted. In English, it says given yourself over. But it's interesting. Lihitmaker in English, in Hebrew, is an addiction. And now he gives him the standard verse 21 and verse 22 are the standard condemnation of a king, where the king is condemned and he's told that his royal office will be terminated. Now, what do I want to focus on here? The question, of course, is this is the first time that we've seen this being told to Ahav. 1 minute, I've got to just change my. I hope this will be okay. Just 1 second, I need to get a better interconnect. Okay, I think I'm still with you. We're good. This is a better connection. Okay, so this is the first time Ahab is told that he will be condemned. Last time, after the war, he was told that you let this man go, your life will be instead of your life. But we don't get this condemnation, which means your royal house is going to be terminated. Okay, it's true that he told him you're going to suffer for this, your nation is going to suffer for this, but he didn't tell him you're not going to be the king. Why now? And here I want to turn to two very famous passages of the Rambam, which I think are so critical. The Rambam says, and you see it on your screen, although, he says, there are cries more serious than bloodshed. Yesh avonot chamurim mishfichut damim. In other words, maybe things like idolatry, which are a direct affront to God. None lead to the destruction of society like bloodshed. Even idolatry, he says. Okay. By the way, the phrase here is hashchatat yishuvo shel olam, the destruction of literally the fabric of society, the fact that people can sit in this world. And I've got to tell you, as I'm saying these words, I'm thinking very much about what's going on in the Ukraine. He says, even idolatry, or needless to say, prohibited sexual relations or desecration of Shabbat, or not bloodshed in this respect. For those belong to the category of transgression between man and God, where bloodshed belongs to the category of sins between one human and another. Anyone who commits such a sin of bloodshed, is a thoroughly wicked individual. All the commandments before throughout his life are not equal in weight to this sin, nor will they save him from judgment. And we learn this, interestingly enough, Se'olamad me Ahav. Learn this from Ahav, Oveid Avodah Zarah. What was his title when we first met him? There were none worse than Ahav because he worshipped idolatry. Because it says, and here's the verse, Rak lo hayak Ahav, there was no one like Ahav. However, it says, When his virtues and his sins were lined up before God, what was the sin that brought him to death and destruction? There was no sin which condemned him to destruction other than the sin of Navot. Okay? And he says, and in this case, he didn't even kill him. He just caused his death. All the more so if you actually cause death and destruction. Likewise, the Rambam warns us about our desires. And he says, for the Rambam, there is a mitzvah of lotachmod. There's even a mitzvah before lotachmod of lotitaveh. You're not allowed to allow yourself to even have any element of desire. And if you take a look here, he says, desire brings a person to coveting. And coveting, so first, even allowing yourself the desire, and coveting leads to theft. For if the owner of the object that one desired is not willing to sell, even though one offers a hefty sum and pleads with him, then you'll come to steal, etc., etc. And if the owner confronts him so as to save his property or prevent him from stealing, then he'll come to shed blood. Go and study the story of Achav and Navot. Once again, say olamad mimase Achav and Navot. What's happening here is that the Rambam clearly looks at this story as a story which is, we really have to learn from in two ways. Number one, this chain of desire. Somebody allows themselves to want something so much so that it consumes them, they can't get out of bed. And then people will do their bidding, especially when they are powerful people. And second of all, just to understand, Sefer Malachim is so focused on idolatry. It is the sin of Sefer Malachim. For every king, we say, did they do right or wrong? And it's a question of whether they commit themselves to idolatry or to monotheism. There's only one real major sin, except for one chapter. And that's this one. This one where we see murder. And it's interesting, the only other person who's really called a murderer, right, is Menashe, who's the other great idolater. Is there a connection between Shvichut Damim and Avodah Zarah? Not for this year now, but I will simply say that it's amazing that despite the fact that Malachim is so Avodah Zarah, so idolatry focused, this is what brings Achav down and the Rambam is picking up on it. I'll finish off with one last thing. We've literally got 1.5 minutes and that is the last line. We're not really going to have much time to do this, but let's just read the Pasuk 25. Pasuk Hafei, Rak lo haya ka'achav, there were none like Achav who gave himself over to evil in the sight of the Lord. And then the next phrase, under the incitement of Jezebel, his wife. Who's culpable? Achav who gave himself over or under the incitement of Jezebel, his wife? Ultimately, they both get a death sentence. Okay. But what he's saying is, on the one hand, he's guilty. On the other hand, she's also guilty. Or maybe I should say, what we're going to have to say about Achav is, that ultimately, he is, when in front of Izebel, he has no backbone. He has no backbone in front of Izebel, and he is a very fickle character. We saw it before when he killed all the prophets of Baal and then comes home, and Izebel says, oh, that Elijah is going to die, and he doesn't say a word. The last point, verse 27, when Achav heard those words, he rent his clothes and put sackcloth on his flesh, and fasted and lay in sackcloth and walked submissively. And the word of the Lord came to Eliyahu at Tishbi saying, do you see how Achav humbled himself before me? Because he humbles himself before me, I will not bring destruction in his days, but in his son's days. I'll delay the destruction. Here there is a huge debate. Achav doing tshuva? Do you really think he's sincere? And here there's a big debate. Some people say, no, he was really sincere. He really fasted and he wore sackcloth and he, in his latter days, really did tshuva and God accepted his tshuva. And in that case, we learn a very important lesson from Achav. However bad somebody is, God will always give them a second chance. The other option is that it was more cosmetic. It was more cosmetic. And even though he says the royal line will be given one more generation, we're going to see that in the very next chapter, Ahav will meet his death in war against Ben-Hadad. So it's not like God keeps him alive for very long. So whatever God says when he says, he's humbled himself before me, we don't see much evidence that Ahav was given much more of a chance. It's true that Ahav was not assassinated, and his sons got a chance to rule. And yet, this really is, the next chapter will be the end of the road for Ahav, just a 3 years after he capitulated to Ben-Hadad. So this is what we have here. A lot to absorb. I agree with Elaine. Ahav was scared to death. Okay. And I like Gershon Hepner's Sota based on Hisata. Very interesting. Esther and husband and wife in the story. I don't know, you can think about that. Fascinating. Okay, you're going to have to excuse me because I actually have to run to another shiur and I don't really have time to engage in people's questions, but I've got another shiur starting 2 minutes ago. So we will meet again, but Ezra Hashem, next week. I hope that everything will be smooth next week. I'll actually be at a conference next week in the United States in California. So I hope that I'll have good internet and we'll be able to meet at the same time, same place. So hopefully all will be smooth and we will meet up then. L'hitra'ot, have a good week, everybody. Next week, we'll see the end of Ahav, the last chapter of Malachim Aleph. If you can, read the chapter. It'll be very worthwhile for our learning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.